Blog Talk Radio.
You are about to enter into the world of the paranormal. Of ghosts, UFOs, demons, Bigfoot, and generally anything unexplained. We live in a diverse world where we don't fully understand everything that happens around us. These are the topics that we are discussing on Paranormal Horizons. Stay tuned with your hosts, Jason Ophir and Sherry Pang, as we look a little deeper into the world of the paranormal. Paranormal Horizons begins now. Greetings, everyone in Internet land. I'm Jason Ophir, and welcome to another episode of Paranormal Horizons, here always with the beautiful and talented Sherry. Sherry, hey.
Hey, Jason, how are you?
Doing pretty good. Hey, and before you give a brief introduction on our guest tonight, I had a I saw a little bit of disturbing news online, and I'm sure it's bogus, as with everything else that's reported online, but I found it to be a little bit interesting. And what I saw was basically, and we've heard this sort of thing before, that the world is going to end not in a couple years, but next month. How do you feel about that, Sherry?
I don't think so. I don't feel that way. Who made that prediction anyway?
Well, supposedly there is a known asteroid or something that NASA's found. And NASA claims that it's going to fly by us by 33 million miles. But there's a Russian astronomer who is swearing up and down that, according to his research or whatever he does astronomically, that this thing is dead set to hit the planet.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, if it's time for us to go, it's time for us to go. That's the way I look at it.
Stock up on bottled water and hopefully have a basement, because it's going to be supposedly a Earth-ending event. So, yeah, pretty traumatic. And you heard it probably first on Paranormal Horizons. So who do we got lined up tonight? I know you've done a lot of excellent work finding us guests, and I know we have an awesome guest set up this evening, and I see that he's patiently waiting in queue.
Yes, tonight we're going to welcome for the very first time David Weatherly. He's very well known, very renowned in the paranormal field, and I have so too much to list as far as his credentials and his experience. Anyway, I would like to give him the floor as much as possible. This guy has a wealth of knowledge, and we just like to share that with our listeners. So I'm really, really happy and very blessed to have him on the show. So we're just going to bring him on.
All right. We'll get him on right now. Hey, David.
Hey, good evening.
Hi, David.
Hey, thanks.
This is Sherry.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I'm good. I might have to bow out of this interview tonight, because if we've only got a month left, there's probably a lot of things that I need to take care of. So.
get your affairs in order. So
that doesn't leave us much time.
No, it really doesn't. So, David, give us kind of like a bio on you. Now, I've talked to you before. You probably don't remember. It was on a completely different show. But let our listeners know a little bit about yourself. And, yeah.
Sure. Well, I've been doing this for over 40 years now and exploring really all aspects of the paranormal or the supernatural, if you will, from Sasquatch to UFOs and haunted sites. And just have always had a real passion for it. I've been writing quite a bit in the last few years and put some books out. Some people recognize me from appearances on things like Ancient Aliens and some other shows. And you know, this is what I do full time, so it's not at all old or boring to me. I'm constantly fascinated by the things that I explore.
David, I know that you've written books on BEKs, which are black eyed children. Have you personally ever been confronted by them?
No, I haven't.
Okay, that's fine. Thank goodness for that, huh? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I get asked that all the time. You know, in my time in the field, I've seen an awful lot of strange things, but that's not one of them.
Now, I know it sounds like, I mean, we could cover so many different subjects, and one of the ones that I wanted to cover was that, and I have to be honest with you, I am a pretty huge skeptic when it comes to black-eyed children, because, you know, I know you can buy those sclera lenses and stuff like that, and with the people that you've interviewed over the years, do you feel that they actually exist, and if so, what is their purpose? What are they doing? Like, how is the typical black-eyed children encounter happen? Because people out there might not know a lot about it.
And that's completely fair that you feel that way. You know, a lot of people still don't believe these stories because they're so creepy. And at the same time, you know, it's something that is possibly easy to host. But what I encourage people to do is to really, if you're serious about determining whether or not you think this is something that's actually happening or not, you know, really study the cases, and you'll find that there are plenty of cases that predate the invention of those sclera lenses. To answer your other question, a typical black-eyed child encounter, a black-eyed kid encounter, is that these children will approach someone, whether it's at their home or at the person's place of business. Sometimes it's just a car in a parking lot, and they will try to gain entry. The classic case, of course, in a modern sense, is the Brian Bethel encounter. Happened in the late 1990s in Abilene, Texas. And if anybody knows anything about the BEKs, they know this account because it's the most popular and most well-known one. Bethel was going down to pay a bill at a strip center. He was going to write a check and drop it in a drop box. And he was sitting in his car when two kids approached him. They came up to the driver's side window, and Bethel was not in a bad neighborhood, but he felt a bit uneasy. So he only rolled the window down just a little bit enough to be able to hear these kids. And they appeared to be regular kids at first. They had, you know, fairly drab clothing on, and, you know, the head's kind of hanging down. And they started talking to him and saying things like, "Hey, mister, we want to see a movie, and we forgot our money. So we need you to take us home to get our money." And Bethel had the clear enough consciousness to look over at the movie marquee and realize that the last showing of this film was already well underway. So, you know, it wasn't really making any sense from the get-go. And clearly he was very ill at ease with something that was occurring with these kids, and they noticed that he was hesitant. So they became a bit more insistent and pushy. And they were saying kind of odd things like, "Come on, mister, we're just a couple of kids. Let us in the car." And during the course of this, as the encounter unfolded, the kids finally made eye contact with Bethel, and he saw that they both had completely solid black eyes. So that was enough, kind of set him over the edge. He threw the car into gear and pulled out of the lot. And as he was driving away, he looked in his mirror and realized that these two kids had completely vanished. Now, this incident is really, it kind of sets the hallmark for a lot of the things we find in these cases. Odd requests from the children, a sense of nervousness or unease with the victim that rapidly develops to the flight response. And, of course, the solid black eyes. There's a few other things that go with it, you know, the pale and pasty skin, strange mannerisms, sort of a monotone way of speaking. But these encounters, they really sort of started spreading like wildfire with the advent of the Internet. Bethel posted his account in an early forum, and when other people read it, they said, oh, I've seen something like this too, and they described their encounters. So there's a handful of them that became really well-known, a well-known part of the Internet lore of the BEKs. The intriguing thing was, you know, I had heard about this at the time and thought, okay, well, this is interesting. It could be an urban myth. It could be, you know, something born of the Internet. But as the years went on, more and more of these cases were reported, and I started meeting people who had actually had encounters with these kids. And the more I delved into it, the more I found some really intriguing connections. There's so many aspects to these encounters that correlate with other types of supernatural phenomena, be it the alien grays or you know, demonic entities or a wide range of things. So when I set out to write the book, I really was determined to find out if this was, you know, something that was completely modern or something much older. And what I found when I wrote the book and in the years since then is that there are more and more cases that are surfacing from well before the Internet and even television. It's just that you have to take away that acronym, BEK, because that's what's modern. When you take that away and start looking at the hallmarks of these cases, then you find a lot of older encounters that fit the same paradigm.
How far back does it go? Does it go back, you know, like to the 1800s? Like, where was the first reported case?
Well, when I did my research, I found a really solid one from the 1950s. Now, and that's in the book. But since the book has come out, it's been 5 years now, a lot of other cases have surfaced. And we're seeing a lot of them from the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, and you know, there's been some more recent ones from the 40s and 30s because more people are researching this and looking for the same identifiers in the encounters in old accounts. It's like I said, you just have to take away that acronym and start looking at the parameters of the encounter, and you'll find a lot of very old things. But, you know, one of the things that's fascinating to me is that they found a statue. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Göbekli Tepe or not.
No, archaeological site.
Yeah, okay. So the archaeological site, known as Göbekli Tepe, they found a statue of what they have dubbed the Urfa Man. Now, what's fascinating about this is that Göbekli Tepe is full of all these very strange carvings and, you know, different types of animals and totems and things like this. But they have found one singular statue that doesn't, there's nothing else similar at the site. It is a humanoid figure that is carved completely out of stone, but these ancients who carved this thing, time to go and retrieve black obsidian for the eyes.
Wow.
So, you know, we really have to wonder, they didn't do this with any of the other statues that are at this site. This is very unique. The statue has been dated to over 13,500 years old is what the statue has been dated to. And we really have to wonder, you know, what the ancients were trying to depict when they carved a black-eyed being. And, you know, I have not been to that site personally. I've spoken to a lot of people who have been there, people like Linda Moulton Howe and Robert Schock, the archaeologist. And, you know, all of these people, hands down, tell me that standing in front of this Urfa Man is a bit disturbing. There's something very unsettling about looking at this thing and being in its presence and just having those black eyes sort of peering back at you. And it's really curious because, you know, I hear the same phrases from people who are traumatized by these black eyed kid encounters.
And I was reading on that, and when the people have had confrontations, they're obviously your life is never the same. But also there has been effects, after effects, like they've been falling ill, death, things like that, that in the result of a confrontation of that.
Yeah, that's correct. It's essentially like talking to a trauma victim when you interview these people. It really is. And, you know, many of them have after effects ranging from broken sleep patterns to paranoia to physical illness and a wide range of other things.
David, do you believe that those are random, that they just come to anybody? It could be anybody. It could be you, me, whatever they decide to pop up, right?
It seems to be because, you know, as an investigator, whether it's a UFO case or a haunting or whatever, you look for patterns. You look for things that sort of line up, that line up that you can build some data around. And when I started collecting the cases, you know, I really attempted to find similarities amongst the cases, the victims, and everything else. And it's very, very difficult to do with these black-eyed kid encounters. Now, you know, I was really delving into this and researching it, oh gosh, 7 years ago now when I wrote the book. So, you know, we're constantly getting cases, and myself and a dozen or more other investigators who collect these things are constantly getting these accounts now. So, you know, I don't know if there's a new pattern that has emerged if all of that data was collated now. But I can tell you at the time when I wrote the book, there were very, very few similarities amongst the victims. You know, there was a wide range of age, ethnic background, religious belief, and everything else. One of the few patterns I did find was that there were a large number of people who encountered these things that worked in, that had positions of authority in their lives. So law enforcement, military personnel, government officials. There were an unusual number of those in the cases that I collected who had encountered these children.
Has anyone ever, like, if they're approached at their house, has anyone actually let them in?
Not that I have personally, you know, there's not a case like that I've personally pursued where someone's let one in their home. There's quite a few accounts that are floating around out there now, you know, people saying that, you know, I got the black-eyed kids in my house and now I'm dying and things like that. And I think a lot of that is a bit, I question some of those stories that I see. And of course, it's always difficult when you can't directly interview the witness yourself. There is one case that is in my book where someone let one in a vehicle and it led to a really strange set of circumstances.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine. That would be kind of terrifying. Is there any idea? I know some people believe that they're extraterrestrials. According to your research, has there been any kind of consensus on what they actually are, what their motive is?
No, that's kind of divided. You know, when I wrote the book, as I said earlier, I found it intriguing that there are similarities with a lot of other types of phenomena within these cases. So it's one of these curious things where you could easily make an argument that, okay, well, these are, you know, possibly some kind of demonic entity. But you can equally find enough things to support the idea that there's some type of alien hybrid, if you support that hypothesis. So that was actually one of the things I found most fascinating about the accounts when I started delving into them. And I really wrote the book from a perspective that I just presented all the possibilities and information and let people make up their own minds. What I find for the most part is that people are pretty split. There's a large portion of people that think there's something demonic, and there's an equally large portion of people that think they are something alien, some type of hybrid. And then, you know, a few other people here and there that think, you know, different things, that they're some other type of entity, possibly a djinn or something like that.
Well, they can stay away from me. I have absolutely no interest in seeing a black-eyed child. My life is complicated enough. I don't need any worse luck. But I find it absolutely fascinating. Like you were saying, it seemed to become really popularized with the internet, and kind of, I imagine it's kind of a lot like the Slender Man thing, because I think people are claiming they see the Slender Man, you know, which I don't even know if that's a real thing or not. But
yes, the Slender Man is a whole other fascinating topic, and there are, in fact, I've interviewed people who claim that they have encountered Slender Man or at least something like him, but we're in a very, very different territory when we start looking at that, and I think that Slender Man is potentially the modern manifestation of a tulpa.
What's that?
Tulpa is an ancient Tibetan word, and it essentially is a entity that is created first from pure thought. The ancient Tibetans believed that if you followed a certain set of meditations and projections, that you could start to realize something in your mind, in your consciousness, and that if you focused enough energy on that, you could bring it into reality. Now, what's fascinating about the Slender Man, and I don't know if people, you know, listeners know the story of Slender Man or not, but this is, it's pretty compelling to look at the whole history of this thing. You know, we can easily trace the history of the Slender Man because he was created on an internet forum during a contest. There's an online forum, as far as I know, it's still up. It's called Something Awful, and these folks decided they wanted to have a contest, and they wanted to see if they could create an image, a photoshopped something that was paranormal related, and make it go viral on the internet. So the contest started, and people were throwing in, you know, different cryptids and different UFO type of things and all this different stuff. And then this user posted a picture that was is a little bit vague at first. It was kind of a allusion to this character. He wasn't even named initially. He eventually became the Slender Man as the whole thing unfolded. And in fact, the entire thread in this forum was taken over by the idea of the Slender Man. This was back in 2009. So 2009, you know, this guy is making this thing up essentially. And the person's name is, he was posting as Victor Surge, but his actual name was Nudston, Eric Nudston. And in interviews, he's talked about the fact that really what he was doing was trying to tap into the idea of the boogeyman, you know, the thing under the bed or hiding in the closet. So he was sort of tapping into this very subtle fear that a lot of people have, that there's something lurking just there in the shadows. And in fact, the Slender Man is exactly what he does. As this lore was built, the idea was that he was this tall, faceless man, often with extra arms. As the name implies, he's incredibly slender or thin, and he was responsible for causing people to disappear. So as the mythology unfolded, a video series was created called Marble Hornets, and it was sort of a documentary-style series of stories about this guy's encounter with the Slender Man, and he eventually disappears. So it became this really strange phenomena where all these other people started adding to the mythology. And, you know, people were creating woodblocks that they claimed were from the 1500s that depicted something like the Slender Man. You know, other people were bringing in cases from the 1940s and different eras and saying, oh, this happened, and they were tying it to historical events and other unsolved mysteries. And this thing really took a strange hold over the internet. In fact, so much so that people independently who were not affiliated with the thread and didn't really know anything about what was going on, they started reporting encounters with something that they described as sounding like the Slender Man. There's old coast-to-coast shows where people were calling in to George Norrie reporting these bizarre encounters, and they're describing the Slender Man. You know, they're saying that they've encountered this figure. Now, there's a couple of things that are interesting about this. One is that Nuston really did tie into some old lore about, you know, the Dark Man, Der Schwarzmann is what it was called in German, and some other characters that were sort of a part of folklore here and there, just bits and pieces. But the other thing that I think is a possibility with this situation is that, you know, for the first time, we've got something like this manifesting virtually from the collective consciousness. You know, we're living in an era where Twitter can send something to the other side of the world in seconds. And, you know, an event happens and it's known in multiple countries. So, you know, this is a very different time for us as human beings with our collective consciousness. When you have that many people focused on the idea of something existing, you know, what does it create?
I had no idea about the backstory. Now I'm glad I asked you about that because I had no idea that's how it started. What do you think, Sherry? Have you ever?
That's amazing. I can't imagine. Go ahead.
And it's a bit disturbing too, of course, because I think most people in the field now are aware of this incident that occurred in Wisconsin. In 2014, and ironically, the year prior to that, I had been touring doing a lecture on tulpas. There's a DVD available of this, and I was talking about this whole idea of the Slender Man and how problematic and actually dangerous it was because, you know, you have mass numbers of people focusing on something completely sinister and negative. So shortly after that, you know, we saw this incident occur in 2014 in Wisconsin, this little town where these two 12-year-old girls attempted to murder a classmate. And, you know, this has just been made into a documentary. In fact, it's been airing on HBO this month. If any of you haven't caught it and you're interested in it, you know, you should check it out. It's called Beware the Slender Man. And it's a very... it's disturbing on the level that it goes into the mindset of what these kids were, you know, thinking. And there's interviews with the girls. They were incidentally just ruled, it was just ruled that they would be tried as adults in court for this attempted murder. So it's, you know, something very, as I said, very disturbing that we're still seeing unfold.
I do remember that news story. Do you ever get discouraged? I know, like, when I'm looking into the paranormal, there's, you know, you go to YouTube and watch UFO stuff. It seems like everything's faked, and it gets really discouraging, and I think it does a disservice to legitimate people, you know, having legitimate experiences and then investigators. But there's so much fakery out there, fake stories, Photoshop, video editing, and it's hard to know what's real or not. So I pretty much don't believe anything anymore because of that.
Yeah, you know, if you let it get to you, it can make you really, really jaded. But I guess that, you know, I don't spend a lot of time sitting on YouTube watching that stuff because, frankly, you know, so much of it really is a waste of time. You know, I'll watch things from reputable people and people that I know personally in the field. And, of course, you know, I spend a large portion of my time actually out in the field investigating cases. And, you know, it's just a very different world. When I started doing this stuff, you know, it was not cool. It was not part of pop culture. So I really had to beat the bushes and do it the old school way and talk to people and go out to the locations and things like that. And that's still my approach. You know, I use the internet as I can for a lot of things. But, you know, I think that if you're into these topics and you strictly limit yourself to just doing it online and hoping to find, you know, something really useful, you've got a tough road to follow.
That's
are there
advice.
Yeah. I was wondering, now, out of all the 40 years of research that you've done, are there any, and this is kind of, I know we're going to be bouncing around a lot, but are there any cases or anything regarding any subject that really had compelling evidence to where, you know, it was one of those things where you're like, yeah, this, there's no way this is fake. Are there any things with any other subjects that you could share with us?
Sure there are. I mean, there's cases that I've been on, you know, there's haunted sites I've been to that the evidence is just a bit out there and just too much, you know, to be false. I mean, it's things I've personally investigated. There's other well-known cases too, and some cases that are not as well-known. You know, ufology, you bring that up, and it's in some ways ufology is a bit of a troublesome field because we have this situation where there's a couple of mainstream organizations that really want to kind of grab all the headlines, so to speak. You've got a large portion of ufologists who are completely fixated on, you know, a couple of things like Roswell. And, you know, if you really want to devote yourself to that, that's fine. Okay. But, you know, if you're really looking for some compelling cases, there are other places to look within that field. You know, in recent years, the Travis Walton abduction has gotten a lot of media because, you know, Travis travels a lot. He talks about the case a lot. And some of the other guys who were present have come out with him. But there's other cases that just don't get a whole lot of attention that are kind of mind-boggling. I mean, one that really, really fascinates me is the Zanfrida case out of Italy. And it's just an incredible case. It was investigated by the Italian military police. The case was closed because they frankly couldn't figure out what was going on. Now, this is in the 1970s. And, you know, Zanfrida had these encounters with these bizarre creatures that he described as sort of reptilian with undulating skin, as he called it. He had bizarre incidents that multiple people witnessed, strange lights in the sky, situations where he radioed in at one point. He was a security guard. He was driving his vehicle, and he was on the radio telling the person back at the base that they had taken control of the vehicle. Now, when the authorities made it out to where he was, where he was last reported, they found him on the ground. It was pouring raining, but I can't recall. I think he may have been dry, but I know the car was dry. The car was dry and hot. They found these massive footprints. The military police, they kept finding all these things that were baffling to them. And they finally rubber stamped the file, no crime committed, case closed. Because they couldn't find any answers. And, you know, Zanfrida, he was initially ridiculed in the media because, you know, all of a sudden he's the UFO guy. And you know, it was kind of a joke back then. So to try to prove his case, he agreed to undergo hypnosis, and he did this on live television. He did this while dosed on sodium pentothal, and you know, which is, as some people may know, is a truth serum. Literally, you know, you can't lie under the influence of this stuff. And you know, he recounted the same series of events that he had been reporting the entire time about these strange aliens. So it's an incredible case. It absolutely is. It's recently, there's one book that was written about it, which has recently been translated to English, but I think a lot of people are still just not aware of the whole set of encounters.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard about that. I don't ever remember hearing of something with undulating skin. That sounds kind of trippy. Weird.
Yeah, there's if you kind of Google it online, go on and look. I wrote about his case in my Strange Intruders book, but if you go online and Google the case, you'll find there are drawings that were done from his descriptions of these aliens, and they really are just bizarre looking creatures. They're, you know, sort of tall and greenish, and they have these sort of triangular shaped eyes, and these they're vaguely humanoid, but they're also sort of reptilian looking, with these long things that sort of stick off the sides of their heads. It's a very odd case.
What was this guy's name again?
Zanfretta. It's Zanfretta.
Okay, I'm really curious, so I'm actually looking right now. I want to see what these things look like. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's like nothing I've ever heard of before. It looks like a scary monster with triangle-shaped eyes and weird things coming out of the side of the head. Huh.
Yeah, and this is just one example of the, frankly, the variety of, quote, aliens that have been reported over the years. You know, people, again, if you say alien these days, what automatically comes to everyone's mind? You know, the little grays.
Grays, yeah.
With, of course, the large solid black eyes and you know, the small and creepy thin bodies and so forth. But really, if you delve into ufology, especially prior to the 1980s, you find so many cases with a wide variety of alien beings that were reported. It's just that, you know, once Communion came out, which Whitley Strieber published in the 1980s, it sort of almost set the standard. And, you know, people like Bud Hopkins really started delving into these cases and looking for some consistency. And I don't fault them for that, but I think what was happening was that a lot of researchers got set on the idea of, okay, we're going to look for these cases with the alien grays because that's what everyone has seen, and that's what's probably correct. But, you know, really, again, there's a wide, wide variety of alien beings that have occurred over the years that people have encountered.
Now, 20 years ago, I was involved with my own alien case, and actually Whitley Strieber was involved in that. But that's a whole long story. There was evidence left behind, and he was kind of the conduit that sent it to a lab in Texas, and it was unexplained. There was government stuff going on and just craziness. That's why I'm so into UFOs, because I had my own experiences. But based on your research, what in terms of the grays, have you been able to learn anything as to what their purpose is? Are they kind of like drones where they do all the work and there's a higher being that controls them? Or what's up with them? Because that's the most, like you said, most commonly reported.
Right. And, you know, that is the impression you get, at least that I get after looking at so many cases, that they're almost drone-like in their behavior. You know, you do get the sense that there's some kind of a higher consciousness that is guiding them and directing them, you know, in terms of what they do. So, yeah, I'm in agreement with you on that. I'd love to hear your encounter sometimes. It sounds pretty interesting.
It's craziness. There was a metal object that was left behind under strange circumstances, and it was a really it's hard to just even describe this artifact. And they sent it to went to Whitley, who sent it to a lab in Texas, and they couldn't identify it, and there was just all sorts of craziness that went on. And this was a long time ago.
What happened to the object?
It was eventually sent back to the researcher up in Portland, and he's got it hidden away. But there was a lot of crazy stuff going on. There was like people taking our pictures, and weird people in the middle of the night installing these strange electronic boxes outside of our place. And I went out and checked out one of these boxes. It was completely sealed on stilts. They went out and installed it at 3 a.m. and went out there once they left. and it was like humming and vibrating, but you couldn't see any power going to it. And there were just a lot of like encounters as well. It was just a very weird time. Nothing's happened in a really long time, but the whole thing kind of died.
So were these like MIBs?
No, these were like people. Like they pulled out there and installed this thing. The weird thing was is I had buried this object under this in nearby, and then like a day or two later they pulled out and installed this thing. So I went and because I didn't want the object in the house, so then I went and recovered the object. A day or two later these people come out in the middle of the night and they take their electronic box, and I'm not talking a small box. This thing was, you know, 15 inch square or on each side. And it was just craziness that was going on for a long time. And but to this day it's still unidentified.
Wow, interesting.
The lab that I don't want to talk too much about it because I'm not the guest, but the lab that had it, you know, they did the mass spectrometry on it, and they wanted to do this isotopic ratio testing, but what we were told was that the military was the primary contractor of the lab, and the military told the lab that if they continue to do this independent testing, that they won't use them anymore. So that's why the testing stopped and the object was sent back to the researcher in here in Portland.
Interesting timing.
Yeah, interesting timing. So I don't know if it had anything to do with it or what. But anyway, yeah, if you ever want to talk about it, we can connect off the show.
Yeah, definitely. Sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, so anyway.
I have a question for David. Can you tell me a little bit more? I'd like to know, what about the women in black? What are they?
The women in black?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my friend Nick Redfern has written a book on that. Essentially, if you're familiar with the men in black cases, you know, there's really a lot of similarities. The men in black are these sort of creepy characters that show up in a lot of UFO related cases, and they often will try to convince people to not talk about their experiences. They'll show up to UFO witnesses, people who have had encounters, and they'll, you know, discourage them from saying anything about what they witnessed. And in recent years, there have been these cases where these strange women in black are showing up in some situations. And like the men in black, they're described in a similar fashion. They're said to usually be wearing some type of wig, of having, you know, strange eyes, being dressed all in black, speaking in an odd manner. And it seems pretty consistent, you know, with the men in black. It's just that they, you don't really get the sense that they're, you know, maybe not quite human, or if they are, they're intentionally doing something very strange to obscure, you know, who they really are, what they're really doing. And granted, there are a lot fewer cases of women in black, but, you know, there are some out there, and Nick has dug up and found quite a few of them in recent years.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah, primarily they show up and try to tell people to shut up. It's the short version of it. You know, these men in black stories, there's a lot of people that believe that there's some type of government agents, but then there's other people that think that, you know, they're not really human, that there's some kind of disguised alien, or, you know, there's even people who think there's something robotic. And again, you hear the same types of things when you look at the women in black encounters. But oddly enough, this is another area that when I was exploring the black-eyed children accounts, there are actually a lot of similarities between black-eyed kid encounters and men in black encounters.
Really? Wow.
That's interesting stuff. What about... I know we're jumping all over the place, but I'm trying to think of some other interesting topics. What about Bigfoot? you ever run into any evidence regarding that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, and in fact, I just started putting out a series. It's not my latest book, but I released last year a book called Woodknocks, which is a technically it's a journal. It's called Journal of Sasquatch Research, and it's a compilation of pieces from both myself and several other cryptozoologists, noted people in the field, like Lyle Blackburn, Ken Gerhard, and that's contributions on different aspects of the study of Sasquatch. Now, the piece I wrote for that is on Bigfoot encounters on the Navajo reservation out around Four Corners. So the idea of the series, and Volume 2 is coming out actually this spring, and we'll have a couple of recurring people and then some different contributors. The idea is for this to come out once a year with a rotating cast of cryptozoologists contributing different pieces on the study of Sasquatch. It's a really popular topic right now, again, with the television shows that have spiked a lot of interest in different areas of the paranormal. Of course, Finding Bigfoot has been tremendously popular the last few years. So it was kind of a good opportunity to put something out that was a little bit different, and I'm real happy with how it came out.
That's awesome.
Do you feel that that actually Bigfoot does exist? We've talked to a lot of people about it. I'm kind of skeptical on it because my argument always was that, well, I mean, they must die. Wouldn't we have found a body, you know? So surely there would be better evidence.
Yeah, that's a common argument. But the thing is if, again, you know, if you get out in the field and spend a lot of time out there, you realize a couple of things. One is that there's a lot of wilderness in this country. People often, and most people live in cities, and they have no concept of how much wild area there still is in the United States, because you look out your window, you know, if you live in L.A. or New York or, you know, Miami or whatever, you look out your window and you see everything is developed. There's people everywhere. And, you know, even if you drive out of the city, you're basically in the suburbs where there's still tons of people. But, you know, look at a map sometime, especially of a region like the West. One of the primary examples is the state of Utah. If you look at the state of Utah, which is a very large state, there's one primary interstate, it's I-15, that splits right up the center of the state. And the larger percentage of the population of the state of Utah live right along that corridor, right along that interstate corridor. So that leaves an awful lot of wilderness area. Now, there are some people out there, you know, there's Native Americans, there's rural areas, and so forth. But you go out there and you know, and you can do this with any state. You go out to those areas and you start hearing a lot of accounts of these creatures. Now, as to the question of, you know, why does no one find a body? Well, bodies of animals, even large animals in the wilderness, they really don't last very long. You know, I have talked to a lot of park rangers, and years ago when I was really kind of looking into, constantly asked park rangers, guys who'd done it, you know, 5, 20, 30 years or more, and say, you know, how often have you found the body of a bear? And, you know, they don't. They just don't. So, you know, we're looking at wild creatures that live in the wild and they die in the wild. And I don't think it's very unusual that we haven't found a body of one of these creatures yet. I just don't. And, you know, if there have been bodies found on something like a Native reservation or something like that, they very well may be quiet about it and just not say anything, because the Native view of these creatures is a bit unique from what other people's are. And, you know, they would be much less likely to try to drag it back to, you know, put it in the sideshow or anything like that. So I don't think that's not a question that disturbs me.
That's a good point. I don't think I've spent a lot of time out in the wilderness, and I don't think I've ever found the body of a bear. I hadn't actually looked at it like that.
It's a large animal. I mean, that, you know, and if you add other factors in, of course, there's an awful lot of people that believe that Sasquatch has a higher degree of intelligence than any of these other wild animals. So there is some potential that, you know, they could drag away their dead to somewhere. I mean, certainly we see animals like elephants that do this. So, you know, they an older Sasquatch may intuitively know some place to go to pass away, or, you know, may be helped by its, you know, family or pack members or whatever they are, even though they appear to be somewhat solitary creatures from a lot of the accounts. There are still plenty of encounters out there that people have reported seeing, you know, more than one in the same region, and of course, juveniles.
Wow, that's interesting. Hey, what do you think about mermaids? Do you think they believe they do exist?
That's been a really popular.
I had to throw that one out there.
Misidentified sea creatures, you know. But you know the things that I think that we're going to continue to see revealed from the ocean. I think that is a really intriguing area because there are some people that you know are now talking about going to much greater depths in the ocean, and this is again, this is something that people don't realize how little of the deep ocean we have explored. I mean, it's only a tiny, tiny fraction, and you know, we've probably mapped more of the moon than we have the ocean bottom. And you know, some of the things that are starting to surface, of course, are proving some of these ancient myths, you know, like the giant squid, for instance. And, of course, one of the hallmarks of cryptozoology, the coelacanth, which was, you know, presumed extinct and then, you know, one surfaced and then another. And since then, a couple of different populations of them have been found over the years. So I think we're going to see some really interesting things over the next several years out of the ocean depths, for sure.
I believe so, because I saw some pictures that were really some very unusual, strange creatures. Like you said, they were not something that you most people would, you know, capture on camera and stuff. You're absolutely.
Yeah, now, you know, they're starting to find all of these different, you know, creatures that live basically down in complete darkness and are bioluminescent, and I think it's a very fascinating area. You know, I loved area of study. I loved Jacques Cousteau when I was a kid, and you know, you see the progress that's being made now, and it's kind of mind-boggling.
Well, I'm looking at the clock, and time has just flied by. We still have a few minutes left, so I wanted to make sure that you put out where people can get your books or if they wanted to get in contact with you.
Yeah, sure. The best spot is twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com. That is T-W-O-C-R-O-W-S paranormal.blogspot.com, just like it sounds. The books can, most of them you can find on Amazon.com. The new book that just came out, gosh, it's less than a week old, is Haunted Toys. And I co-wrote that with a friend of mine, Ross Allison. And it's already literally been out only a few days, and it's already doing really well.
Haunted Toys.
Yes. So let me ask you, do you believe that objects can be haunted? That's because that's a great subject. That just brought up a great subject.
Oh, yeah, I sure do. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So,
you know, again, it's linking around to the idea of the human energy field, and we really know so little about what we can do, you know, what our potential is. Science, quantum science, is just now starting to delve into some of these ideas of human energy and, you know, what we can do energetically to influence other people or heal our own bodies and so forth. And I think the more and more we learn about that, the more that's going to tie in with some of this phenomena that people experience, because, you know, an object that is, you know, held by a person for so long, or is that, or that is instilled with energy in a wide variety of ways, can, I think, retain a lot of that residual energy and eventually sort of take on a life of its own to some degree or another, or at the very least hold so much energy that it becomes a conduit for other things to occur.
So don't buy things secondhand or antique store, right, David?
Well, I guess it depends. I mean, I do that all the time. I've got tons of haunted objects. But, you know, in general, I don't recommend it for people who, you know, who aren't prepared to deal with the potentials of what those things may bring.
Unless you inherit them by your beloved family member.
Right. Well, and sometimes people want to get rid of those, too, so.
I see people on eBay selling stuff that they claim to be haunted, and I think to myself, it's probably a scam, but why would anybody want to buy a haunted object? Like, what if it's really haunted and you're going to cause grief to yourself? It just boggles my mind.
Well, you know, I've had them for years. I mean, it started off, you know, when I was investigating these cases, and, you know, as far back as the 80s, I would encounter people that, you know, there would be something, in an object in the home that was haunted, and they would just want rid of it, want somebody who could deal with it. And, you know, I ended up doing it a lot by default. But I think in modern times, it's, again, a lot of it has to do with pop culture. You've seen shows like Haunted Collector. You know, Zach Bagans did his show on his haunted museum. And the idea of having all of these paranormal-related objects, I think, has led a lot of people to say, oh yeah, I'm gonna do that, and I'm gonna build my own collection and so forth. And a large portion of the time, these people don't know what they're getting into, because you really do have to handle these things in a careful and calculated way.
So what happens if you have a demonic doll? What happens if you burn it? Is that bad to destroy something like that?
It often is to do it in that way, because if it's an actual entity, you know, negative entity or energy that has attached itself to the object, then all you're doing is destroying the object, but not the energy or the entity, which is now looking for someplace else to go.
Which theoretically could be the person. It's all very interesting.
Yeah,
and I stay away from it. I don't want anybody to send me any haunted objects, because, yeah.
It's okay.
Thing.
They can send them to me, so.
Yeah, there you go. Well, it looks like we're out of time. Go ahead, Sherry.
I do believe that, like dolls, they, you know, the souls can be trapped in them, you know, whether they're mannequins or dolls. I feel that way. I mean, that just, it's just, you know, just something I don't know, just something to be aware
sure.
of.
Oh, sure. And a lot of people have a phobia of those. You know, I was on, many years ago, I was on the island of the dolls, and, you know, I don't have a phobia of dolls, but it's a really creepy place, you know, because there's just so many of them there.
Oh,
that's that.
They're a vessel for spirit.
Swamp place with the dolls hanging from these branches, isn't that what that is?
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. No, thank you. Well,
oh,
it looks like
goodness.
We're out of time. So I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show. And I don't know if it was you. I think it was. I sent you a friend request on Facebook. My profile picture is a cat. So a cat that looks like it's terrified. So that's me. If I send it to the right person, maybe we can hook up sometime. I can tell you a little bit more in depth what went on a long time ago.
Sounds good.
And
I will double check that and accept it if I see it on there.
Awesome. Well, we'll
thank
have to get you back
David.
On sometime.
Oh, yeah, sure. Anytime, guys. Thanks
well,
for having
we'll
me
like,
on.
Yes, we'd like to have you back on. We'd love to. Thank you. There's so much in this field to talk about and learn and share. It's amazing.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Thanks guys.
David.
Have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, right, Sherry. Wow.
Wow.
I mean, it's just like so many subjects.
I know. There's so much to talk about. It's amazing. But anyway, next week, I think we're just going to have open lines. I think it's the first of the month. So let's, I'm planning on having open lines, don't you? What do you feel?
Yeah, as always, I like it. It gives us a chance to talk a little bit more, and there's always tons of subject to talk about. And hopefully by then I'll be able to do a little bit more research on this asteroid that's going to wipe out humanity next month and see if we can get any more definitive answers on that. But you know what? I was thinking, if you got to go, that's a pretty spectacular way to go. I mean, why not some giant asteroid? I mean, that's better than sitting in a bed dying of cancer. I mean, yeah. What?
Exactly. Well, live this day, each day, you know, as a blessing, and count your days, because you never know from one moment or another that you can be gone. So, you know, just love and as much as you can and enjoy the moment. Take a deep breath and just, you know, enjoy the moment and be present. That's all we can do.
I know I'm seizing the day, and I'm going to seize the day a little bit further because I have these restaurant-style tacos to go eat, so...
Oh, my goodness. That sounds good. I love tacos, and we'll have to get it together, Jason.
All righty.
Okay.
Well,
thanks,
everyone,
you.
For tuning in.
Yes, and it's been a good show. And like I said, next week we'll have open lines and have listener participation. So, yes, we'll just take it from there.
All right. Hope everybody has a great week, and we'll see you next Sunday. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everybody. Peace.